Okay, couple of announcements first that I made already through Moodle. First of all, the exam, I decided what kind of exam I'm going to give to you. It's going to be a, from the experience of the first weekly quizzes, because I had some questions about whether it's possible to extend the time window for taking the quizzes. So I extended that to 3 hours. From 16 until 19 on each Friday. And also the actual course exam is going to be, I will give you the possibility to take it in 2 days. The first one was on 18th November, and the second one was on 16th December. And in both cases, it's going to be a 2 hours exam based on multiple choice questions. So the weekly quizzes give you an idea about the nature of the questions, what kind of questions I will be asking. Be sure that they will be more difficult than in the weekly questions, a bit more like applied ones, because the first, let's say, impression from the first weekly quizzes is that they were fairly easy to you. 21 students answered the questions in the first week, and 19 out of 21 got the 1 point for the exam. So you did it very well. Okay, good. So let's continue now to this discussion about the negative interest rates. First of all, I gave you some instructions on readings for this first lecture of this week. So I instructed you to take a look at the slides from 137 to 155, which are these term structure of interest rates slides. So we will be starting the discussion, or we will be going the discussion about the current situation in the money market interest rates, interest yielding assets, regarding whether you understood the ideas in the basic theory that lies behind the pricing of these money market instruments. So how many of you did take a look at these slides? Okay, good. So we can start the discussion. So you should be aware of the first component in the discounting idea of interest rates. What is the main important thing in the very short term is about the liquidity. So the expectations hypothesis gives you an idea about the calculation of the relationship between longer term interest rates and shorter term interest rates. And it's once again about expectations. Then when we extend the theoretical models towards more like the whole term or the maturity structure of all the interest yielding asset markets, we go towards, from the expectations theory, we go first to the segmented markets theory, and then the preferred habitat and liquidity premium theory together. So basically, when you try to calculate or start to analyze the relationships between interest rates between different maturities. So you should now bear in mind all the time, as the starting point for your analysis, this expectation theory of interest rates, because it basically gives you a very simple factorization of all the interest rates at different maturities. So liquidity lays the basic background for everything. And it comes from the idea that the first maturity that you would be interested in investing as an alternative to plain money or cash is the shortest term interest yielding asset markets. So as you extend your portfolio towards more maturities, longer maturities, the risk regarding everything that has an effect on the longer term interest rates increases, because there are many things that have an effect on the longer term maturity. But basically, you can sort of summarize everything to this figure. What are the constituents of each and every interest rate asset at each maturity? So the expectations theory lays the background for everything. And then when we start to discuss about the liquidity premium, we add the term spread there. That is just the difference between the longer term interest rate and the shorter term interest rate. And then liquidity premium and preferred habitat theories are additional components. They are related to the role of different kind of investors in the asset markets. Like for example, life insurance or insurance companies are concentrating on the long-term assets because by the law, they are required to do that. They have to be a long-term investor in asset markets. So they have a preferred habitat for investing to longer term interest yielding asset markets. So basically, when you start discuss about the term structure of interest rates, you should be able always, as a sophisticated economist and financial market professional, to be able to conduct some kind of ideas about the future development of the interest rates based on the differences between the interest rates at the moment from different maturities. So this is the idea for drawing the so-called yield curve. So these are yield curves for various market situations here. I think this was the last slide, or slide number 154. That gives you an idea about the future behavior of the short-term interest rates when we are talking about upward sloping yield curve. What can you say about the expectations regarding the future values of short-term interest rates when we have these two first cases here, steeply upward sloping or mildly upward sloping, nevertheless, upward sloping yield curve? What are the market participants expecting about the future development of shortest term interest rates in these cases, these first two cases, A and B? Yeah, well, when we are focusing a situation, let's assume that this is from yesterday. We have observed for some markets, let's say for Sweden, for example, for the shortest term of interest yielding assets, i.e. at the below than 1 year maturity. We are drawing the interest rate quotations for each and every maturity from 1 week up until 12 months. Then we are covering the whole money market structure or money market maturity structure. When we are observing the situation that the shortest maturity, this is the weekly maturity, and the last point here is the 12 months maturity. So we are drawing these interest rates, there they are here, yield to maturity is the interest rate on these assets. So we are drawing them from yesterday for each and every asset. Now that you have taken a look at the slides regarding expectations theory, what is the expectation for 1 week maturity interest rate? Is it going to increase or is it going to decrease? It's going to increase. Yeah, the markets are expecting that if there is so clear difference between the 12 months maturity and 1 week maturity, the shortest term, the 1 week maturity is going to increase in the future. It has to increase to stabilize the demand and supply conditions in the markets. Because we are playing with the same discounting principle that we discussed last week here. So simply when we are discussing about same kind of default premium assets, so we are discussing about the money market rates only. It's quotations between banks that are allowed to issue these zero coupon bonds that are being used for calculating the money market interest rates. When we have an upward sloping yield curve, then we have a situation that the markets are expecting that the very short term is going to increase. What about this situation? Yeah, slope is negative, so the term spread is decreasing with the maturity. So it implies that ceteris paribus, if nothing else happens in the markets, if the inflation rates and currency values stay the same and there are no additional market participants, basically, then for these market participants in these markets, they are expecting that the shortest term interest rate will come down. And these are the things that you should immediately be able to see when you take a look at quotations, for example, in Financial Times or Kauppalehti or anywhere else, regarding the different quotations of interest rate at various maturities. Take a look at the differences between them. And in macroeconomic context, there's a huge amount of literature that has been doing research on the forecasting ability of this difference between the interest rates at various maturities. Whether they are able to forecast the future real economic activity or inflation or many other real economic variables. And in empirical research, it has been found that they are able to a degree. But usually they you have to include additional information. But the term spread does have an explanatory power regarding the real economic activity. And this is the thing that actually, for example, in the US markets have been followed quite closely, that what is the difference between the different maturity interest rates? Because in the US market, especially, it seems to be the case that they are able to forecast the real economic activity in the future. I have also done some research on this thing. So if any one of you currently, I'm supervising one master's thesis regarding this, I think whether during the negative interest rate era in the euro markets, European markets, this term structure of interest rates idea or this theory has been working in relation to the real economic activity. I discussed with the student last week and he has very interesting results. It does not seem to be playing at least in the same power that it used to be playing before. The quotations on negative interest rates, if you don't introduce some kind of uncertainty measure regarding the real economic activity to the model. But when you introduce some kind of uncertainty measure, it will actually retain its explanatory power. And actually, I want to go now back after we have taken a look at these simple things in the expectations theory of the term structure of interest rates theory, let's go back to the discussion of negative interest rates here. Because this is something that we discussed last week, that it's a thing that disturbs the standard discounting ideas. Because if you think about the preferences regarding current consumption compared to the future consumption, when you have an incentive to take more loan now because you have to pay back less of the notional amount of the loan in the future under negative interest rates, it should give you an incentive to consume more now. And that is the theoretical reasoning, actually, as an overall idea for all the central banks that have adopted the negative interest rates. It should be boosting the real economic behavior now. But can you say that it's boosting the real economic behavior now? Yeah, there's a lot of uncertainty in the economies, and the agents have already been more or less used to the situation that the central bank at the European level, ECB, is going to be using unconventional monetary policy actions. So they are going to be issuing more money in the future, the short-term money and longer-term liquidity also to the banks in the future. So basically, it seems to be the case that it might be not beneficial for the agents to consume now, because in the future you could be observing even more negative interest rates. So they are postponing now the consumption decisions once again. So this is a really, in theoretical, to an economist mindset, it's really awkward situation. And the original idea also regarding the discussion about the role of negative interest rates can be based on the very standard paper or the study by Irving Fisher. And he denoted already at the end of 1920s that if a commodity could be stored costlessly over time, the rate of interest in units of that commodity. So we are measuring things in real units, in terms of consumption units all the time, could never fall below zero. But we have now seen that the modern central banks and the interbank markets allow this principle actually to be broken. So this does not hold anymore. It is possible. Up until 2015 or 2014, in the standard economic textbooks, we didn't discuss about negative interest rates at all, because we thought that it's not possible, it's not a possibility. But I have been teaching this course for 20 years. I started from University of Oulu, and I mentioned the possibility already at the beginning of these courses that because we get the quotations for the interest yielding assets, zero coupon loans from the markets, it might be the actually case that they can't be negative. The price changes at the aggregate level can be negative for each and every asset there in the markets. So now we have seen that actually for a long period of time already, almost 6 years in the European markets, for the euro markets. And it seems to be fairly difficult to get rid of this thing. One of the home assignment themes will be for you, I think it's in home assignment two, actually, that you have to discuss the most recent research. I give you the examples of the research about the possibilities of getting rid from this thing. What would that require? And to my mind, this new European level salvage package, the European Commission level, would have been a possibility to get rid of these things if we would have skipped that one and allowed all the individual euro area markets or countries take their sovereign debt more. And the pricing of the debt would have been completely based on the supply and demand conditions and default premia of the individual countries. That would have given a possibility that we would have received quotations for the interest-yielding asset markets for government bonds that would have been based on positive interest rate, the positive interest rate requirement, because the default premium is so big in some countries compared to some other countries in relation to the survival from corona crisis. But we seem to be losing that possibility now. But it might be the case that the whole package will not be utilized up to the limit, and the politicians and economists would start the discussion about the possibilities of increasing the role of the sovereign debt markets more. And having that common debt, European level debt, as a kind of a plan B after some of the countries are not able to get the funding from the markets, then we will go to the European level debt. Okay. So basically, from an economist point of view or economics point of view, we can really say that the negative interest rates, era of negative interest rates, it's a highly monetary policy phenomenon. It's designed for the purposes of easing the liquidity situation of the interbank markets, to provide liquidity to the banking sector to enable them to give loans more to the private sector or the public in general. So the history of this is actually, we can blame our dear neighbor, Sweden, from this actually, because the Riksbank was the first that quoted negative interest rates as early as in July 2009. At the European level, that was the first one. So, and they have been, Riksbank tried to get rid of this situation actually just before the corona crisis came the fall of 2019, they announced that they would be aiming towards a positive level of money market interest rates, because they noticed that it's something that actually disturbs the standard discounting ideas in the markets. And the markets are nevertheless performing very well. Real economy is not performing very well, even though they quote this negative interest rates. And ECB lowered the deposit rate to minus 0.1 in June 2014, so that was the first step. It came back, the deposit rate, main refinancing operations deposit rate came back to a positive side in July already. But more permanently, we can say that at the euro area level, the market interest rates have been negative continuously from October 2014, when the Eonia mid-rate, euro overnight interest rate between the banks. So it's for very short-term lending between the banks overnight. It went constantly to the negative side, and it has stayed there. Okay. So other European countries and Japan joined the Riksbank later. And this is now something that was, this is old information according to Fitch ratings. Over 10 trillion worth of also government debt is now carrying negative yields. At the moment, it's around 13 trillion. So it's a huge amount of money that is carrying at the moment negative interest rates. Okay. So what is the current situation? This is the situation from the end of August when I finished the first set of these slides to you, because I wanted to give those to you in 1 week's advance. So Euribor 3 months, it's pretty much the same at the moment. 3 months Euribor was minus 0.477. 12 months Euribor was minus 0.369. And here we have quotations for 2, 5, and 10 years of maturities. I have received this from DataStream. You have access to that also. So in general terms, when you remind yourself about the ideas behind the theory of term structure of interest rates, what can you say now? How would the situation look like at the moment? Is this part of theory working still, or is it not? We can say that the standard discounting ideas are more or less disturbed at the moment, but nevertheless, what can you say about the situation in the, let's say, government bond markets that carry at the moment over 12 trillion euros worth of assets in quoted in negative interest rates? What can you say about the functioning of the theoretical ideas of the term structure of interest rates? What kind of slope do you observe in the government bond markets? This is from 31st of August, so we can draw similar kind of figure for the term structure of interest rates regarding the government bond markets at 2, 5, and 10 years maturities using these values. What can you say about Spanish term structure? What is the slope of that? Shortest one is minus 0.47, 5 years maturity is minus 0.21, and 10 years maturity is at the positive side. So what's the slope of the yield curve in the Spanish markets? Yeah. So what are the expectations regarding 2 years bonds? They are expected to increase, because it would seem to be the case that the term slope of the term structure, the government bond markets, is still positive. And if there's nothing to be said about the real economic activity based on the idea of the forecasting power of the term structure of interest rates regarding the future real economic activity, what could you say about this? Does this indicate a positive forecast for future real economic activity? Yeah, at least for these maturities. So pay attention to the maturities all the time. We are discussing about the fairly long-term period now, when we are already discussing the shortest maturity in the government bond markets. We are discussing about 2 years. Anything can happen with regards to the corona situation within 2 years. So things may happen. If things go worse, it might be the case that the yield curve turns back to negative. It was actually last year when I presented the same slide in the same course, some of the yield curves for some of these countries were negative. Actually, in the US case, we observed a negative situation. I'm not saying that term structure of interest rates can forecast the corona, but it seemed to be the case that for some reason or other, the markets were already going down for future development, or had an idea that the market in the US economy is going to be going down, situation is going to be going down. But now it's seeing that in the, let's say, at least 2 years maturity or 2 years horizon, it might be the case, based on the quotations from the government bond markets, that the real economic activity might be increasing in the US. And it's obvious that now that we have experienced this very huge slack in the economy, negative growth rates for more than one quarters, actually for three quarters in most of the economies, it's easy to forecast now that because of the level of the GDP has lowered so much, it doesn't require very much to have a positive growth rate in short-term measurement already, if we are calculating the quarterly changes, for example. And now that the US economy has actually, it might be stabilizing a bit, they are now forecasting that the actual final effect on the unemployment rate, for example, of the corona crisis, it's around 8%. So within a 2 years time, they would be achieving a situation where the unemployment rate is not more than 7%. So that actually implies that the real economic activity is increasing, and vice versa, unemployment rate is decreasing. So they are the two sides of the same coin. So for all these markets, at least, it would seem to be the case that yield curve is sloping upwards. So the term structure of interest rates is having a positive slope in terms of the yield curve. So it would be implying that the markets are expecting that the very short-term interest rates, or even at the 2 years maturity of the government bond rates, it might be the case that they are rising in the near future. And the same applies to the European level in the money market interest rate, but you see here obviously that simply based on the ideas and the expectations hypothesis of the term structure, the differences in these values are not so big at all, because the term to maturity differences in the terms to maturity are very much smaller there. So the time between 2 and 5 years is in absolute terms, much, much bigger than between 12 and 3 months. So I just want to sort of alert you that you should be following from now on, follow these things very actively. And if you start to see quotations that for similar kind of default premia, similar kind of assets, you start to see higher interest rates at the shorter maturity compared to the longer maturities, it's an alarming information regarding the real economic activity in the future. It's an empirical fact that has been found in the previous literature. We have observed in some very short occasions that when the yield curve turns the slope, then in the near future also there is some kind of turn in the real economic activity. So it does have a forecasting power. Okay, so what are the theoretical reasonings for using this negative interest rate by the central banks? Theoretically, it should be based on the idea that banks would very much be more be willing to lend money to borrowers and earn at least some kind of interest rate, as opposed to being charged to hold their money at the central bank. Now they have to pay, if they want to hold their money in the central bank deposits, they have to pay minus 0.5 for all those deposits at the central bank. So it's a clearly, it's a big cost when you have 10 billion euros to be saved, deposited to somewhere. It should not be an incentive to deposit that to the central bank. You have to pay so much. You have to pay 50 million euros, for example. So negative rates charged by a central bank may carry over to deposit accounts and loans at, let's say, early years of quoting negative interest rates. This was not even possible. But nowadays, we are starting to observe a situation that even for the private customers, the banks are willing to pay negative interest rates. And in the Nordic markets, some of the biggest banks have been paying already negative interest rates to the deposits of their biggest customers, and they are usually firms, from 2017 already. It has not been discussed. It's not publicly announced, because it's not good. It's not good business for the banks. There's always the danger the customer will withdraw all the funds from the bank or the deposits, but they have been paying already. So this is a reality already now. So once again, that should be an incentive to all the agents to start consuming and start acting more actively in terms of real economic performance. So one of the reasons has been also at the moment high on the agenda at the ECB level is that through these very low values of interest rates, also at the negative side, it would be devaluating the euro. And at the moment, euro is fairly strong. So it's actually one of the incentives for ECB, even now, to keep the interest rates at the negative side. This development actually started already before Corona, but for some reason it has gone now in that direction that the euro is stronger and stronger against the US dollar at the moment. So low or negative yields on European debt will deter foreign investors and weakening demand for the euro. And in general terms, the idea is simply to simulate the economic activity and stave off inflation. Inflation pressures are not high. At the moment, inflation is very low. Variability in inflation, the variance of inflation is almost zero. It doesn't vary a lot. But one of the things that has a role there to inflation at the moment is the very low demand for energy sources at the moment. Like the oil prices have gone down quite a lot. But in the, let's say, 5 years' time, it might be the case that the oil prices are not playing so big role anymore in the general inflation, because alternative forms of energy sources are now starting to play a bigger role in the future. Okay, but the main thing here is the strengthening of the real economic activity through these measures. So, what are the pros and cons of negative interest rates? At the positive side, we would like to very much see that it would be spurring up the consumer spending, but it doesn't seem to be the case very much. Experiences from that were fairly mild already before the Corona crisis. And in intuitive terms, it should be the case that it should be enhancing the consumer spending and taking more debt, because the cost of taking debt is very low. So in real terms, real rates of interest, even with a very small rate of inflation, the real cost of debt is still lower than the nominal cost. So the real interest rates are very low during the negative nominal interest rate era. And here are the consumer confidence figures that seem to have a role to play here. They have some explanatory power regarding the low effects of extremely loosening monetary policy actions regarding the future consumption. So ESI is the European Sentiment Index. It's quite low compared to the normal value of 100. It was quite low still in August, but it has now improved after the opening of the borders of individual countries. So it might be the case that the situation is improving. So uncertainty regarding the corona effects is perhaps, let's say, in 6 months' time lower. It's very much dependent on the vaccine, whether we are able to develop a working vaccine when immediately after we have developed that and it will be given to the general public at the global level, the uncertainty goes down. But we have to test that. We cannot use the Russian version because it would seem to be something that it's not quite so safe at the moment, or we cannot be sure about that. But nevertheless, from some country, we will have the global vaccine. And it will, in terms of economic variables, a successful vaccination program will have an effect on the uncertainty at the aggregate level. And it will be seen also in the market behavior and also in the development of real economic activity. This USCCI is US Consumer Confidence Index. It's also very low still. And it has been lowering actually compared to the July figures. In August, it was only 84.8, whereas in July, it was still 91.7. So it's going down there. So we will see. But in terms of following, first of all, the quotations in the interest rating asset markets, you should be following any kinds of indicators of uncertainty in the economy. And the confidence indexes are one source of information for these kind of discussions. Okay, so at the positive side of negative interest rate, we also very much want to denote this encouragement of banks to give more loans, because it should be actually quite easy for banks to at least mildly increase the customer level marginals for the banks when the general level of interest rates is very low. But based on the very tight competitive situation in the banking markets, for example, in Finland, the banks have not been very much able to do that, even though the interest rates have been very low at the negative side. And I will give you one working paper of mine regarding the profitability effects of these negative interest rates on the OP banks. And it will be one of the sources or the papers to be used in one home assignment. And we can say that I used the data up until 2018. And it seemed to be the case that the biggest OP banks were able to improve their profitability based on negative interest rates through the increasing rate of wholesale funding. We will be discussing about the role of wholesale funding next week when we go and open up the function machine or the production machine of the banks as firms when we start to discuss about playing with the items in the assets and liability sides of bank balances. And I will be discussing about these results in the OP group, because it seems to be the case that up until 2017, banks were able to improve their net interest margin through negative interest rates, because they were able to get the funding for their loan activities from the central cooperative at the negative interest rate. So even without, they would not give, they would not engage into a money creation process through creating new loans to the customers. If they only put all the extra money to their balance sheets, they would have earned a positive net interest margin for that, because they had to pay negative interest rate on that loan from the central cooperative. So ceteris paribus, without doing anything else, they would be earning, they have been earning by taking a loan from the central cooperative. But from 2017, this machine has stopped working because the banks have not been able to expand their balance sheet or their loan activities that would have given them more profitability, giving loans to the customers in such an extent than before that. So we will be discussing something about those results also next week. Okay, so the basic idea is just that it's all about cost of funding. It should be boosting investments and consumption behavior at the aggregate level when it's so, let's say, cheap to take loans, take more loans. What are the cons? What are the negative things here? First of all, we have been discussing right from the starting of the quotation of negative interest rates, we have been discussing about the bubble possibility. Whether the increased amount of loans that have been taken from the banking sector have been used to a productive purposes or only for purely speculative purposes, like buying more stocks. And it has been actually the case that some of the general public have been taking loans from the banks and buying more stocks. And the stock prices have been increasing in general. They started to increase also in the spring after the major, after the huge collapse in the prices, they started to increase already in April. So within a very short period of time. And the unconventional monetary policy actions actually seem to be one of the reasons for that, because the central banks have promised to give always the liquidity to the market. So it might have been creating bubbles. That is a possibility. But who can tell at which states we are talking about bubbles in the general quotation of stock markets and housing? What is a bubble and what is based on fundamentals? We might say that 60% of the valuation of the stocks at the moment in the markets are bubble, because the fundamentals are not going very well. But if the bubble enabling funding from the central banks nevertheless enhances also part of the real economy, part of that goes to the enhancement of real economic activity, then it's a beneficial thing. And the bubble might sort of smoothen out from the behavior of the prices in the future. We will see that what happens in, let's say, 6 months or 12 months time in the markets in general. Then there have been some discussions about the beggar thy neighbor policy in international trade. It means that the value of the domestic currency is always with negative interest rates, so it's a desirable thing for the central banks of export-driven countries. Yes, why not? You can use that, even though in at the euro level, it has not been given as an official target for monetary policies to sort of fight against too high value of the own currency. But it's something that obviously may have happened, but it doesn't seem to be the case that at least in the European level, the unconventional monetary policy actions could have been able to lower the currency enough. We are not doing very well, even though already before the corona crisis, we were not doing so well. So things are not going so nicely as we would have thought or tried to figure before the starting of the negative interest rates, quoting the negative interest rates started. And then we don't have the history for these things at all, because they were not even textbooks at all before 2014. Economists were so, let's say, blind-minded that they didn't even consider this as a possibility, but it's not a reality now. So this is one of the examples why, in many cases, economists should also follow the practical life very well and do empirical analysis always, because the theory is designed to describe the empirical behavior, at least to a great degree, but the development of theories is very slow. So this came from the actual markets as an observation, and central banks had to do this. Okay. It might be the case that there is a risk of bursting inflation at some point of time in the future, and that is actually something that is a worrisome thing, because the amount of money at the moment is so huge in the banking sector. It's enormous. I will show you a figure next week about the extension of the central bank balance sheet, that it's huge at the moment. It's a waste amount of money at the moment. Okay. Then, just to remind you about, basically, this is already a slide about from the end of the term structure of interest rates slides that I asked you to take a look at to be able to discuss with me about these negative interest rates. But you always first have to, when you start to compare the yields to maturity between assets, you have to first take a very good look whether they are of similar kind in terms of the other risk components. Whether do they have the same default risk, i.e. are they from the same country when you are discussing about the sovereign debt items, or are they from similar default risk level firms? So you should compare different maturities in terms of those assets also. Is the liquidity of those assets exactly the same? So if you take, for example, let's say quotations for 3 months and 12 months assets from the US market and compare those to the European markets, you should always pay attention also to the liquidity or the amount of volume of trade, because they might be clearly different. In the US markets, the volume is usually much, much bigger compared to the European countries. And then tax considerations are also very important, because introducing the possibility of having same kind of assets, let's say with respect to the default risk, but different tax treatment. The other one is taxed and the other one is not. Then that obviously is a cost for the one that is taxed, because the net after taxes is lower from that one. Even though the default premium would be exactly the same, the maturity would be exactly the same, liquidity would be exactly the same, taxes may induce a difference in the pricing of those. So here we have the example of various forms of interest yielding assets we have been discussing already here. But now you should be able to discuss about the differences. Why are the corporate BAA bonds always the highest at all times? Because they involve also the default premium. That is clearly the highest in the corporate sector compared to the public sector. So you may have similar maturities for US government bonds as you have the corporate BAA bonds and AAA bonds. So AAA, AAA bonds are with a lower default premium. Similar maturity for the US government bonds. US government has up until now been assumed not to be able to go in bankruptcy. Still, it might be the case that it's not going to default. But we have seen actually cases where some of the state or local government level bond markets have collapsed. There's not enough trading in those assets. Even though the actual municipalities or the states have not gone into bankruptcy, the quotation, the demand for those assets has been so low that you have to interrupt the trading in the markets. Okay, but nevertheless, this is a figure that you can observe in the markets also during the negative interest rate era. And the ideas behind the term structure of interest rates, or the factors, various factors that we have introduced to that model, are playing now their role in this figure. So that gives you an idea why the development of these from each and every time point, basically, it should always be the case that more you have default premia, more you have liquidity premia, more you have term premia, the higher is the interest rate. the lower is the price of that asset. Okay, so we are, in some cases, we are discussing about this risk structure. So basically you can do these comparisons between different kind of assets in terms of their differences in the default risk by, for example, comparing the T-bills, which are the US T-bills are the least risky forms of long-term investments. You can compare those to the same maturity corporate bonds, their quotations. So if there comes an increase in the default risk of the corporate sector due to the lowering of real economic activity, for example, or for example of the corona crisis, it will shift the demand and supply curves of these assets. It will have an effect on especially the demand curve at the first stage. So it shifts the demand curve for T-bonds if you have considered the same maturity of those and the liquidity in the markets is pretty much the same. Ceteris paribus, if there is an increase in the default risk of the corporate sector due to the corona crisis, for example, it will lower the demand for corporate bonds. And if the T-bills are the alternative for those, then it will shift the demand curve for the T-bonds to the right and shift the demand curve for the corporate bonds to the left. So you can do the analysis based on this thing. So if the investors were supposed to hold in the future also the corporate bonds with the increased level of default, they should be paid a higher interest rate compared to the current situation. So that is the reason for observing a lower equilibrium level of prices for those if the supply of bonds stays the same. So these are the secondary market supply and demand curves. If the supply stays the same, then the prices of those corporate bonds should go down. You should be paying more interest to the investors if they were supposed to hold them also in the future. So it raises the price of T-bonds and lowers the price of corporate bonds. So we have pretty much, we are assuming that they are complete substitutes. So they, you can substitute directly from the corporate bond market to the T-bond market. So they are complete substitutes to each other. So it will have a similar size of effect to the interpercentage terms to the change in the prices of bonds, the T-bill market compared to the corporate bond market. Okay, so you can do these analysis, but you have to always remember that even though we are discussing about the interest rates already, right from the beginning, taxation of the bonds and corporate bonds, the T-bills and corporate bonds, it's applied to the interest yield. But nevertheless, the market situation, the market equilibrium is referring to the prices, price quotations. Remember that always. So you can draw this also in terms of the interest rate, just to have to remember that as interest rates go down, then the prices go up and vice versa for that asset. Okay. So obviously regarding the default premium, we have various sources for credit ratings, and these are the Moody's and Standard Poor's and Fitch are the three major credit raters or the credit rating agencies. And usually their opinions about individual, let's say, sovereign debt items or corporate debt items, they are pretty much the same. But in some cases, we can actually observe that when the firms change these credit ratings, it might be the case that the Standard Poor's, for example, reacts the first to the worst information from the firm or government sector, and the others follow that. And in some cases, actually, these rating agencies consider similar kind of information with a different weight. So they might not be changing exactly to the same, in general terms, 95% of the changes in credit ratings go to the same direction. comparison between different firms. But I have been doing, regarding the banking firms, I have been doing some research with Jari Mikker about the credit rating changes in these credit ratings. And at sometimes, during the extreme periods or crisis periods in the markets, there are clear differences in the time span of these changes in the credit ratings. And it's an interesting thing that whether that is seen in the quotation or the valuation of those firms in the markets. In some cases, you can see that. But nevertheless, for example, if you get a quotation like the Finnish government bonds, I think they have been checked last week or the week before that. So the general rating for the Finnish sovereign debt was AA+ still. So we are being treated as a very, very good investment grade classification securities in terms of our sovereign debt. So we should be able to get at the very low level on the interest if we need more funding for public expenses from the market. And that's one of the reasons why I was not so eager to speak in favor of this European level salvage package, because Finnish government would have been able to get the funding at a very low level of interest. We would have been able to sell all the extra debt in the markets at a very good price and a very low interest rate. But it's something that will not happen. Okay, so here are the, so at the onset of the global financial crisis, the difference between the corporate government, corporate bond sector and the public sector assets increased a lot. So this is an example of analyzing the sources of the crisis. Where do they come from? Do they come from the corporate sector or banking sector, or how are they coming to the economy in general? We observe this thing in default risk that was stemming from the banking sector mainly. So the banking firms started to get very low quotations. Okay. So risk, when we talk about risk, this is now going to the wrong direction actually. Sorry about this. Taxation, I should have been discussing with. Here. So. This is the last thing that I was supposed to discuss here that gives you an idea about the role of the tax effects in bond interest markets. So during the Obama administration, the Congress approved the legislation that favored the administration to increase the income tax rate on high income taxpayers from 35% to 39%. So this can be also analyzed in terms of our supply and demand analysis, because the increase in income tax rates for wealthy people helped to lower the interest rates on municipal bonds relative to the interest rate on T-bonds, because the other one was taxed and the other one was not. So this is just a tax premium, basically. So you should always pay a very close attention to, first of all, the maturity of the assets, the markets, where you get the quotations and the maturity of the assets, liquidity in terms of the volumes, how big are the markets, and then to the default premium, and then to the tax treatment of these assets. So there are lots of factors or lots of animals or moving parts that you have to take into account when you make a very simple decision about whether to invest into an interest-yielding asset or not. And we have not even discussed about the role of currency valuation, exchange rates here at all. It's a thing that you will be introduced to or discussed more in the international finance course. But before you start discussing about the various interest-yielding asset market parities regarding their differences in the interest rates having an effect on the currency value, take a recap of these things from this course before those lectures in the international finance course. Probably Vanja Biljak is going to be discussing about these things in the international finance course. So take a recap from the pricing of the same market, same country instruments regarding interest-yielding assets before you go and dig deeper in terms of the effects of currency valuation in investment decisions regarding interest-yielding assets. Okay, so now we are here at the point where we have been discussing about the role of term structure of interest rates. So we are now at the end of, in the slides or in this course, we have now discussed about the ideas regarding the pricing of interest-yielding assets in general. It's not a very simple thing. It is intuitively very simple thing, but there are lots of things that have an effect on this. And now that we when we move on to the behavior of bank as a firm, you should realize that most of the banks are heavily involved in nowadays in trading with these kind of assets. So the difference on the interest rate or term to maturity or the yield to maturity on the asset sides compared to the interest rate or the yield to maturity or the return, there are lots of names for the same thing on the liability side. That should be the source of profits for a healthy bank. That's the original thing. All the other things that come in addition to this net interest margin should be secondary. So basically the fees and other payments from other things like arranging the funding for the general public or getting the funding from the markets, giving the loans or getting the funding from the markets, both of those involve some kind of costs. So you have to get payment for those costs as a banker. They should be secondary. The main thing should be this net interest margin. Difference between the return on the asset side in the bank's balance sheet compared to the costs or the rate of return or the interest that you have to pay to someone else on the liability side. That's the main thing. That is the original purpose of a bank as a firm, to be able to make uses of this. So banks make profit primarily from asset transformation. So that is the primary production process of a bank. It gathers information about those agents in the economy, firms, households, public sector, foreign agents that are in need for funding, and gathers also information from the same economic agents or the economic sectors that are able to provide funding, and acts as a simple transmitter of information, but it gives a price to this information. It takes a fee from doing these actions. And the main fee or the main source of profit or source of fees is the difference in the interest rates. That is the reason why I have been putting so much effort on the discussion about these simple discounting ideas, because it should be a dynamic process for a bank. You should be able to somehow forecast the future development of your asset portfolio and your liabilities portfolio at different maturities, and realize that at the very short end of the maturities, the interest rates are low, And at the longer end of the maturity, the interest rates are high for various reasons. And on both sides, on asset side and on liability side. So after realizing all these things in terms of the surveillance of the banks, for example, you should be able to somehow calculate the risk-based measures for these rates of returns. So you should be able to calculate the so-called economic capital. In Finnish, it's taloudellinen pääoma. So it's something that all the banks have been required to do since the introduction of the legislation or the supervisor legislation based on the Basel Accords. Banks have been required to do this. They have to always calculate the amount of economic capital that is required to maintain their activities. And all these things that are quoted to the asset sides and liability sides introduce a need for economic capital, especially in terms of for the part of the liabilities. There are various sources of risk that introduce this this need for the calculation of economic capital. The bank economic capital is being used for meeting the demands of the other parties when the bank is failing. So that is one of the reasons. But the simple idea should be, you should realize the simple idea for the bank firm. It's about asset transformation. So it sells liabilities that have a particular combination of liquidity, risk, size, and return. Remember that both sides are being calculated, the risk profiles and the returns. What is the return for each and every component at various maturities with different risk profiles, different default risks, and so on. So basically the term structure of interest rates ideas also play at the background of valuation of all these items. So they use the proceeds to buy assets with a different combination of liquidity, risk, size, and return. For a banking firm, here you have to first realize the first distinguishing part compared to any other firm. What is the first form of asset for a bank? What is the first most important form of asset for a bank? A standard traditional bank. What is the main source of return or interest yield for a bank?
Is it deposit?
No, deposits are at the other side, it's a liability for the bank. This is the thing that you have to remember right from the beginning. Yeah? Loans. They are issuing loans based on the deposits and other funding that they get from other banks and other participants. They are issuing loans. Loans are the ones from which banks get the first source of profit. It's the interest rate that is paid on the loans. And the sort of a basics or the base for the interest yield that the bank can get from the customer comes from the cost of funding. And the funding is denoted or saved in the asset to the balance sheet to the liabilities side. So it's a cost item for banks, because you have to pay something as a banker from getting the funding. Funding comes mainly in the form of deposits, but it can come also in some other forms. It can come as an investment from some other banks to that individual bank. Or it can come as in liquidity issuance from central bank. Central bank is buying some assets from bank A and it's giving funds to be used in the loan process, giving loans to other customers. So try to figure out this thing. Take a recap from the ideas of interest yielding asset markets, about the discounting things, and just remember these two things. Banks make their profits originally, mainly from the difference between the returns on assets or the interest yield on assets. Let's not say discuss about return on assets because it's a definite measure for the profitability. In general terms, the interest yielding assets are there, the asset side. And then you have to, as a banker, you have to pay something for getting funding to some other parties. The customers are the most important source for funding interbank deposits. Okay, so let's go this, we will go this many times through. So let's start by looking at the bank's balance sheet. Liabilities are the ones that are source of funding. Checkable deposits are the most liquid form of liabilities and deposits. They are payable on demand, very liquid. And non-transaction deposits, in other terms, saving accounts and small or large denomination time deposits are the ones. So already here, what is the thing that is the key difference compared to the payable on demand items when you move on to the non-transaction deposits? What is the first form of premium based on the term structure of interest rate modeling that comes into the picture when you start discussing about non-transaction deposits? Sorry? They are not so liquid. They are not so liquid as the checkable deposits. There are some terms that prohibit you to use those deposits directly as like a cash for your buying purposes or something like that. And then the third item are the borrowings. This is a big item also. All the forms of deposits are a big item. But in the interbank markets, these are the things that are being quoted in the liabilities in the form of discount loans from the central bank and borrowing from other banks. So when we discuss about the interbank markets, we are discussing both about the loans from central banks and borrowing from other banks. And based on the price quotations regarding demand and supply conditions in money market maturities, this borrowing from other banks dictates the level for Euribors, for example, in the euro area. And for very short-term treasury funding in the US area. So when you get the quotation, let's say for 3 months Euribor, it's based on the most important euro area banks, wholesale banks, that are in need for 3 months maturity funding and are willing to provide that for other banks. So it's an interbank market. They are trading with those assets with each other. So if there is an excess demand situation in the 3 months Euribor markets, for some reason or other, a big bank comes to the market. Nordea is not a big bank, but let's say a Deutsche Bank still is a big bank and it's surviving. It comes to the market in need for 3 months funding. So there's a huge change in the demand curve for 3 months funding. What does happen to the prices immediately? If the central bank is not willing to engage to provide the liquidity to the Deutsche Bank, it is buying it from the other banks. Yep. price goes up, yeah, but it's in need for, if it needs funding, it's willing to sell the pre-maturity assets, okay? It needs the funding. So it needs the funding in the form of cash that it can issue as a loans. It needs the funding. So it's willing to supply the 3 months assets to the market. It needs the funding in the form of cash. So try to remember always this, that in all activities, in all interest-taking asset markets, the primary source for needs is for your need for cash to issue more loans. Because preferably the customers would like to have the loans in the form of cash because they want to use that immediately. So it needs the funding. So it's supplying the 3 month assets. Okay. Okay. It's supplying. And if central bank is not willing to meet this additional need for liquidity at 3 months maturity, then the additional demand should come from the other banks. So the other banks should be willing to buy the holdings of Deutsche Bank at 3 month maturity. Okay. If they are not willing to do that, then who is the one that is going to do that in any case? Central bank. ECB is going to do that in any case. So when you get a discussion or see a discussion in the financial media or in general media about providing liquidity and needing liquidity, it's this thing. When the central bank discusses about providing liquidity, it's for the purposes of needs of the individual banks at different maturity horizons, because some reason or other, it's a need for 3 month funding. So it will be meeting some remittances of the, at 3 month maturity. It has to meet those. So it needs funding. Okay, you understand this. It's always about demand and supply, always. There's an excess, very short-term excess demand or excess supply of the funds. And the central bank, the ECB, is willing, very much willing to meet all these unequilibrium situations in the money markets at the moment. It wants to provide the liquidity to everyone that is in need for that and for each and every maturity. And there are trillions of euros being traded at the interbank markets every day at the moment, because the demand and supply conditions between the banks change a lot. So this is thing that is being recorded. It seems like a simple thing when we discuss about borrowing from other banks, yeah, but it always requires a counterparty. Someone has to be willing to give the loan to you that are in need. You are in need for funding, so someone has to be always there to give the funding. And the central banks, both in the euro area and in the US economy, they have now promised to be there always for each and every maturity, for each and every bank that they want to have in the market. Also, in the near-term future, they are willing to provide the funding. And when we discuss about this unconventional monetary policy actions, the central bank buyings are not just about the short term now, not just about the 3 months or 1 week or 12 months maturities. They are for the government bond maturities that go from 1 year to 10 years now. But nevertheless, they provide the funding liquidity in the form of cash, in the basically in the checkable accounts that each and every bank has at the central bank. They put the money to that account as a payment when they buy the government bonds from that bank's balance sheet. And at the moment, and that time, the government bonds are holdings of the central bank. And the quotations, negative quotations for the government debt are actually now very much based on this extremely high activity of central banks in these markets. Before the need for unconventional monetary policy actions, we never observed in any country negative government bond yields. Never. That's something that has completely gone out of the hands of the general public, because the ECB and the Federal Reserve are playing such a huge role. So it's quoted there, or it's saved there as a borrowing from other banks. And these discount loans are the first form of, so these are not buying programs. These are just loans from the bank, from the central bank. Individual banks can always go and ask for discount loans. And then at the moment, also the average rate on these discount loans at the ECB system is now negative. I'm not quite sure at the actual level at the moment, but it's very low. These are called the refinancing operations nowadays, but basically they are analogous to the simple discount loans that the Federal Reserve issues to the individual banks. Also in the US market. So they are discount loans. So they take a loan and the interest yield comes as a difference between the lower price at the issue compared to the redemption price. So the interest rate that the banks have to pay to the central bank is usually positive. Nowadays, it's not positive, even that one. They can get the funding also with the negative interest rate, and it improves their net interest margin actually. And that is a ridiculous in terms of theoretical ideas. I've been teaching this course for 20 years and I'm very much against this idea. I don't like it at all. It's not a theoretically valid thing at the moment. But we are in serious troubles in getting rid of this thing now. Okay. Then the assets. The first thing that you have to remember in terms of counting the assets is the reserves. They are funds in an account at the central bank. And these are the funds that the bank, for example, in the Deutsche Bank case, when it wants to have more funding for some purposes, it's in need for funding at 3 years, 3 months maturity. The actual money that is being paid or the cash by the central bank to the Deutsche Bank goes through this account at the central bank. And then in each individual bank has some amount of vault cash, coins and notes, not very much nowadays actually. So the low individual banks are not worth robbing in the traditional ways because they don't hold very much actual cash nowadays in their vaults. And then the cash items are the next thing that are quoted in the assets. So they are deposits at other banks plus cash items in process of collection. Securities, national and local government securities, other securities. Nowadays, banks are reducing the amount of these things because they have been selling a lot of these to the central banks lately. And then commercial and industrial loans and mortgages are the source of basic source of return for all the banks. And then banks have also this physical capital, buildings and office buildings and so on in their assets in the bank balance sheet. So these are the main items. It's about playing between transformation in the asset side, most part of the banking activities considers this. So let's have an example about these amounts of these. So on the left-hand side, like you have been used to seeing or discussing about the firm balance sheets, on the left-hand side, we always have assets, sources of, uses of funding. And on the liabilities side, in the banking firm, we have sources of funding. So on the left-hand side, all that gives you return as a banker, and the right-hand side, everything that induces a cost to do. So the difference between the interest type calculated measures for the proceeds from the left-hand side and for the components or costs on the right-hand side make you, should be the ones that are of interest to you. So reserves and cash items have been at that time in June 2017. They consist of 14% of the assets. And then this is from a US bank for all commercial banks, US economy for all commercial banks, and US government and agency assets were 15%, and state and local government and other securities were 6%. From the liability side, you see that the deposits constitute the 62% of the total amount of liabilities, and actually 72%, because you have to always also calculate the large denomination time deposits, longer term time deposits, and then borrowings from the other banks and the central bank constitute 70% of the all the banks. So as a difference between asset, total asset value, and liabilities, you get the bank capital. So the difference between assets and liabilities is the bank capital. It should always be positive. What if you have a case when the bank capital is negative? What would that implicate? These are the other assets or the asset forms of assets that are being quoted. So the bank capital here is the difference between the amount of total assets compared to the liabilities. So if this guy here, his bank capital goes negative, what would that indicate? Yeah. Exactly, they have spent too much on the sources of funding, so it would imply that basically if this continues for another year and no one like the central bank is willing to save this bank, then it will go into a bankruptcy. It should always be a case that the bank capital is a positive thing. You should have more assets than liabilities. You have every now and then you can have a situation when the amount of liabilities gets to be higher than assets. For a standard household, this is some cases it can also be the case, but for a banking firm, it's not a sustainable thing of doing business at all. So assets should always be bigger than liabilities. Okay, so all these items at the asset side have been given in the decreasing order of liquidity. So the loan portfolio can be partitioned into commercial and industrial loans and real estate loans, which means the mortgage loans and consumer loans and interbank loans and other loans. But nevertheless, all the loans, all the particles in the loan portfolio are recorded on the asset side. And if the bank is supposed to be viable, at least in longer than very short term sense, then the bank capital should be positive. So it means that the difference between the assets and liabilities should be positive. Okay, so let's continue the discussion about these basic banking ideas tomorrow. Take a look at these slides about giving various examples of the First National Bank and other things, the next 10 slides before tomorrow's lecture, so we can start the discussion and remind yourself about the constituents of the balance sheet of the bank, because all the banking takes place at the balance sheet, basically. So that's a production function for the bank. Okay, so are there any questions in the chat room here? Take a look. Chat, there's one question here. Prince has been discussing something about interest income. Well, we have been discussing quite a lot about interest income. It's all about interest income on the both sides of balance sheet. But okay, Prince, send me a question if you have something that you would like to have an answer. Okay, So let's continue from this tomorrow. I take a look at the slides so that I can, we can start playing around with things, because this is the, this is very simple thing, but it's actually the thing that is being doing all the time in the banks. They are playing with the items on the asset side and the liability side, and there are certain costs. Because I want you to discuss in your one of the teams in the home assignment, and one of the questions, be sure, in the weekly quizzes this week will be regarding the effect of negative interest rate on these simple ideas. Where can you see the effect of negative interest rates in practice? And what should you have or indicate to these standard ideas, theoretical ideas? Okay, so see you tomorrow.